things like lasers, where instead of having a 10-second burn time, you can have a 2-second burn time and, you know, jump from target to target. But 100% of that is dependent on making sure that all of your sensors, all of your effectors all work together in a meaningful way. So what we're going to do for error autonomy and ground autonomy is just say, hey, what is the right way to implement these APIs for all of our robots? And then we are going to figure out what the right intermediary layer is without vendor locking ourselves to anyone and without pretending like we know what the right answer is, because we don't.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and my guest on this episode is Dr. Alex Miller. He's a senior science and technology advisor and the chief technology officer working for the chief of staff of the Army. The Army is in a period of rapid and pretty dramatic change. Technology is, for obvious reasons, a big part of that change, and it's really taking shape at all levels of the Army. At the lowest levels, small units at the tactical edge are experimenting with new equipment, and at the highest levels, senior leaders are meaningfully rethinking what has become a slow, often years-long process to buy new weapons and other systems. In the episode, Alex describes the progress the Army is making to transform itself from a technological standpoint. He also discusses what the future holds, and he explains how the service is working now to leverage new technologies to solve some of the most urgent military problems, like defending U.S. soldiers and critical equipment against drones. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Dr. Alex Miller. Dr. Alex Miller, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you are the chief technology officer to the chief of staff of the Army. Listeners will, just from the title, have a general sense of what you do, or at least what your focus is on. But I'd like to kind of get into the weeds, and maybe if you can just start to frame the conversation, just give us a sense of what your day-to-day role for the Army is.
Sure. It's actually hard to talk about the position because it sounds very self-important. The role is important. What the opportunity that General George and Secretary Driscoll have given me is really important. Normally, in a company, when you have a chief technology officer, they generally have some unilateral control over things like the tech the roadmap or the landscape and where funding is going to go. What this role is for the Army, or at least what the General George has allowed me to craft it as, is really being a scout for our soldiers in terms of what is working and what's not, and then advocating for all of the process changes for how we, the Army, interact with tech and our user base. So, for example, normally we go through this very long requirements and acquisition journey where someone who is supposed to be a user rep is writing requirements, and that takes a while, and then it comes into the Pentagon, and that takes another large chunk of time, and then we go and buy something, we acquire it, and that takes another significant chunk of time, and maybe users are involved in that process. Maybe somebody has actually gone out to the field and taken someone and said, hey, here's sort of what we're thinking, is this directionally aligned with what you need? But more often than not, that process has been disconnected from what we're actually seeing day to day. And that's okay sometimes for new things. Like if we were going to build a quantum teleportation device, there's no real, there's nothing in the field today that I can go, hey, is this sort of what you want? Because generally I want to zap myself from somewhere to somewhere else. But for things like drones, for things like the next generation communication devices or analytics on our data, there's something out there that somebody goes, oh, this will make my life 10% easier. And that's where I think I play the most probably impactful part of my job, is going out there and actually being a scout for our users to find what's available now.
It's a new role, as I understand it. You're the first person to occupy this role. General George is the first person to sort of create this position. I guess what should we read into that? Is that indicative of, some recognition of maybe the shifting relationship between the Army and technology?
It is. I think most importantly, it's indicative of just General George's leadership style, which is, don't play to the positions make sure the right people are empowered, and then he gives advice that I've always taken to heart. And it's you know, as a civilian, it's a little bit different than folks in uniform. But he always tells everyone, use your rank for good. So it's creating the position, empowering the right people, and then laying out a clear message on what the objectives are he wants to achieve. So that's sort of the position itself. There is a changing relationship, but I think between the Department of Defense and tech, and what that is really forcing us to think through is not only the tangible relationship, like can I get tech to the field? It is how we do it, how we identify the technology we want, how do we engage with vendors, not only the legacy defense industrial base, but really the American industrial base, all of that innovation that's happening. And everybody's fascinated with Silicon Valley. It's got a huge and lauded history, but really anywhere from the robotics segment that's up in Boston or the folks down in Florida who are working a lot of environmentally sound technology because of where they are, to the West Coast, which a lot of the data and analytics and robotics pieces are growing too. So it's just changing how we interact with the entire tech ecosystem and the processes by which that interaction happens. Because again, every one of your listeners is probably either enamored or infuriated by the way that we acquire technology and what at the basis of what I think my job is. For General George, Secretary Driscoll, it's changing that process, optimizing it, adding a little innovation to the process, and not just being sort of victims to the process.
You know, for a long time, if we were talking about technology, we were talking about hardware for the military. It was about vehicles, weapon systems, equipment, munitions. About 10 years ago, I was having a conversation with the CTO and co-founder of Appian, a software company based in the National Capital Region. He may actually be listening right now. If so, Michael Beckley, shout out. He really sort of shifted my paradigm because he said, you know, the F-35, yes, it's $90 million a copy when it was first going to be introduced. However, we're going to go through iterations of it where we give it software upgrades, sort of the way Tesla pushes out upgrades to its vehicles. You know, I guess what is the balance? Because we also talk a lot about drones, right? We need lots of quadcopters and things like that. These are pieces of hardware. But to make them work, we need a reliable, protected network infrastructure, network architecture that makes best use of them. So I guess, how do we kind of define the balance between hardware and software applications when it comes to technology in your role?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think by now, most people have heard the phrase software is eating the world. It's generally true. The way that we've been approaching most of our tech adventures here, either through Transforming Contact, which is our initiative to give units as much technology as possible to see how they can use it to better their warfighting experience. That's a very customer service friendly way of saying just how do they close with and destroy the enemy better using technology. And then there's this other side of how do we think through the physical manifestation of software, I guess, would be the way that I would do it. So yes, for our entire history up until a couple of years ago, we thought about how we buy hardware. And if you look at the Army's history, coming out of the Cold War into Desert Storm, we thought about the big five. So your Apache, your Black Hawk, your M1 Abrams, your M2 Bradley, and your Patriot. Huge systems, hugely complex, and frankly, still amazing capabilities for the time that they were built and how long we've maintained them. But because they were all hardware-centric, not particularly adaptable. So as we think through the relationship between hardware and software, there's still going to be things that are generally hardware. Like most of our quadcopters, like I've got a quadcopter sitting behind my desk that is just a targetry drone. It's literally a $500 thing that we can fly in a straight line just for counter-drone training. But in the same vein, if I wanted to add some intelligence to that, if I wanted to even simple autonomy like follow me, like some of the social media quadcopters, or go to this site, or a little bit more complicated, I wanted to add a computer vision algorithm and say, hey, find things in your camera field. That is really about how software manifests in the physical world. And that is how we're approaching almost all of the technology that we're doing now. It's what is the thing that needs to be rapidly adaptable? So like networks, we've started introducing software-defined radios, software-defined antennas, software-defined networking for our data and analytics. Of course, all that's going to be software-driven, but thinking about commoditizing the hardware again. So we go through this cycle of, hey, let's do commodity hardware. Let's go to high-end hardware. Now we're back in the commoditized, right-sized hardware for the mission. And then, frankly, it's also thinking through, as we introduce autonomy and collaborative autonomy, how do we make all of these different software stacks work together when they're implemented on robots that have to talk across either a contested environment, or even if it's uncontested, robotics is still hard when you give it a military mission. So there's been a lot of work on how do you do robotics on roadways for like civilian infrastructure. A lot of that goes out the window when your roadway's washed out because it's been raining for 10 days at JRTC, and you have to go off of the road, and there's, you know, lots of brown everywhere because there's either mud or leaves or something else. So that's, as we think through how we manifest software in the physical world, that's really where our paradigm's changing.
I guess I want to ask one more sort of broad conceptual question, and that's, you know, from where you sit in the Pentagon, you know, I'd be curious your perspective on kind of the shifting relationship between the Army and technology, in the sense that, you know, there was a time when, you know, major technological evolutions, you know, GPS, the internet, had U.S. government, U.S. military engineers, scientists, researchers working in U.S. government, U.S. military facilities, actually doing the work to kind of create these things. And over time, particularly as platforms have gotten more expensive, you know, we've seen a shift to where the government is more of a buyer of these rather than a producer of these. So, you know, in terms of the trajectory of innovation, when, you know, sure, it's a large market, the U.S. Army, the U.S. military generally, but still, you have only so much influence about the trajectory of technological innovation. I guess, does that offer any sort of handcuffs in terms of the relationship between the Army and the technology that it believes it's going to need? Or are there certain demand signals, things that can be leveraged to be able to influence that innovation cycle in the private sector?
It's a little bit of all of the above. And let me explain what I mean by that. And I put just a little bit of thought into here. So if you look at Silicon Valley today, almost all of Silicon Valley's upstart was from the Defense Department, right? Yeah. So lots of, and it's not a knock on anyone, it's just a condition that we live under today. All of the investment for the infrastructure, that was the Department of Defense, and that was during the Cold War, post-Cold War, and up through the early 90s when it feels like we had a cultural divorce. So almost all of the things that ride on the internet, the foundation was really developed by the Department of Defense, of course, with ARPANET and DARPANET after that. If you go back even further, almost all of the automobile infrastructure was developed for the Army. So late 1800s into the early 1900s, when we mechanized and got rid of most of our horses, we still have the caissons. So what you see over time is the government subsidizes the development of new technologies and then sets that foundation where once they're democratized, anyone can build on top of that. And I think sometimes we lose focus on the fact that it's okay for us to cede control of the things that come after, because we doing the right thing, basically invented the foundations for that. What we're seeing today and I know everybody's enamored with LLMs. They're very cool. And a lot of the computer vision and a lot of the automation work, we should be focused on how do we implement those technologies into our formations and our processes, particularly in the back end side, and thinking about what the next thing is. Where government R&D should be really focused is inventing the next thing, not inventing the next widget that sits on top of the last thing. Because that's where the commercial market is going to win every single time. I'm a huge believer in free market capitalism because that generally drives the best outcomes, because you have a wide swath of users who are going to tell you what's coming. But what we're seeing in practice is most of the war-winning capabilities, most of them, not all, from the global war on terror actually came from the commercial sector. And then our engineers tailored it to the mission. There were some things, and they saved a lot of our lives, that came directly out of the labs in terms of new electronic warfare, particularly on the jamming side, that commercial just mm-hmm. didn't have an interest in building. But But what we should be focused on, and this is what we're trying to drive towards, is let's use our government engineering expertise, and it is expertise, to invent the next thing rather than trying to maintain control of technology that's already out in the wild. Right? Pandora's box is open. We're not going to invent the next we're not going to reinvent the internet. We just need to build the next internet.
You mentioned transformation in contact earlier. A few months ago, the secretary and the chief announced the Army Transformation Initiative. Unless I'm misreading it, I think that that's sort of broadening the aperture of what came before, which was the Transformation in Contact Initiative and Transformation in Contact 2.0 now. Transformation in contact is really predicated on this idea of bottom-up experimentation and extracting lessons learned and feeding them up into the system, so to speak. That's a very different model than how we've traditionally thought about procurement of technology and systems, which is a top-down, you know, kind of hierarchical, centralized process. If we're looking at transformation and the Army's emphasis on it right now, how do we get the right balance between, you know, letting every unit have a credit card and buy whatever it needs off the shelf and getting, you know, interoperable pieces so that our sustainment systems, for instance, aren't completely broken by this sort of inchoate fueling system?
Yeah. Okay, now we're all working on the problem together. You've identified the problem. I'm of split mind here, and I've had many discussions with the chief and the secretary, because what we're trying to do is figure out what the right mix of just buying the right things for right now, which is very linear. It is, hey, I see something new, I want to do this right now, and then we'll spread that out. And the traditional mindset of the right thing doesn't exist, we need to figure out what the requirements for the right thing are, and then we need to go out and build the right thing. There's still room for that. There's still a need for that, because not the thing that we need to fight tomorrow might not exist right now. There might be edge cases out there, and I say might, it does not everything that we need for tomorrow exists right now. So that traditional process of imagining the future, building a new concept, and then working through the traditional, I need to invent the right new sciences, I need to apply those new sciences, I need to go through sort of demonstration and engineering, that's still valid. What transforming and contact, and you did a great job at summarizing it, what that is focused on is, hey, let's fix the gaps that we see right now where dual-use technology or even just commercial-use technology can be applied to it right now. Let's shore up those deficiencies, and then let's also test a couple of assumptions. So if you're not familiar with transforming contact, what we did up front with TIC was we identified three units, so 2nd Brigade, 101st, 2nd Brigade, 25th ID, and 3rd Brigade, 10th Mountain, and we said, let's infuse you with as much technology as possible. So 2nd Brigade, 101st got our C2 fix network architecture, and what that did is it slimmed down a lot of the stuff that we were forcing the brigade to carry with them. It focused on, hey, how can we make a lot of your architecture unclassified rather than secret, so we can lower the cost for Type 1 radios, we can lower the switching cost for a lot of your comms nodes, we can give you the tactical radio integration kits rather than a lot of the big bulky WinT infrastructure that everybody grew up and you know fell in love with because it was absolutely the best thing ever. But also, how do we think through what some of the decaying boat anchors were? So for example, I talk about this a lot. We had 17 mission command systems. Every warfighting function had multiple of them. So like the Intel guys, which I was one of, as a civilian, we had D6A. And we knew that that wasn't the right thing for the future, but it was necessary because it was part of the architecture. The fires guys had AFATIDs, the air defense guys had AMDUs, the air management guys had TAEs, and almost none of them worked together. Now, I know that is absolute heresy, and I've been getting chastised online by all the folks who think that if you just standardize enough, you'll eventually get to something that's... But I am still a big believer that, you know, the internet works because lots of companies came forward and said, okay, we're never going to standardize what the internet looks like. We're going to use a couple of common standards like TCP/IP, and we're going to use, you know, general schemas like JSON. So how about we just build those out, assuming that if we put out enough documentation, people will be able to leverage it. We, the department, never did that. we just kept falling into this trap that, hey, if you use enough standards, it'll eventually be right. And that's not true. So we had tested a lot of those assumptions, and we started pulling out things that didn't work. And that helped us build the roadmap for things like next-gen command and control, which will kill the majority of the legacy mission command systems and put a much simpler software stack in place, and then have the, as we talked about earlier, the requisite hardware to run that. I know it's easy for me to use hand waves. There's going to be a lot of infighting and arguing on what the right thing to do is, but the Army leadership know doing nothing is not the right thing. So we did that with those first three brigades. And then, like you said earlier this year, we started this Army Transformation Initiative because we said, okay, if transforming in contact is going to scale to the divisions, and we're gonna work on all the division architectures, there's a lot more that needs to go into how the Army transforms, not just modernizes, because modernization is about things, but transforms our culture and our processes. So Army Transformation Initiative is really about how do we reinvigorate our organic industrial base, like all of the ammunition production the Army does for the Joint Force? How do we think through restoring readiness in terms of ensuring that soldiers have the right food, the right PT, the right kit, and they are ready holistically to go fight? How do we close the counter UAS gap, which I could talk about counter UAS forever because it is really important. And what we have focused on in the past has been fixed site protection and sort of point defense. But how do we flip that and think through how does a platoon, squad, team protect themselves from flying IEDs? Because that's what we're seeing with like the FPV drones. How do we make sure that unmanned systems, and I don't just mean quadcopters, I mean everything from the ground robots that we're going to need to the maritime vessels, because the Army has more boats than the Navy, and then the air vehicles. And how does that all work together? How do we actually get to, heterogeneous collaborative autonomy? And then what is the right close combat force capabilities? Things like the next generation night vision, things like Soldier Borne Mission Command, which will be the son of IVAS, and nixed weapons, you know, the lightweight LSAPIs instead of the really heavy gear that all of us took to Afghanistan, in my case, and Iraq, and in most other cases.
I want to talk to you about counter US because I think that is a very, very illustrative, practical example of kind of the implementation of technology to solve military problems that the US Army is facing already and expects to face tomorrow. Before we do, I'm working with an author right now, an Army officer, on an article that we'll be publishing in the coming days, I believe, that's talking about the specific ways UAVs can be integrated into armored formations to make them more survivable, more lethal. It talks about unmanned systems that are integrated not only into higher echelon kill webs, but joint kill webs, so that they can be taskable, say, by other air assets, or that they can they can be involved in calling for fires from surface assets in the sea, what have you. All of these tools are going to come from primarily private sector companies. And if you look back at the history, the past 20 years of tech companies, I mean, think about all the cell phones you had that came with different chargers. You know, they all have their own standards. They all have their own componentry. They all do their own thing. How does the Army signal to the companies that it needs to build these things that we need you to use a certain language? We need you to use a certain, architecture that allows data to be processed along? How can you do that?
I love this question. Because it's a first principles question on what does interoperability mean in the 21st century, and it starts with things like our mission command systems, and then it goes to things like robots. So go on this journey with me a little bit, and there's mixed feelings all around, and that's okay. When I was working in the G2 with our now Army CIO Leo Garciga, then he was the IC CIO, so he was the Director of Information Management. We said, hey, we have to get off of D6A. We have to get to the next generation platform. At the time, we called it the Army Intel Data Platform, because we knew that the 13 different things that were in the D6A portfolio, a good set of Intel professionals could make those hum, but they spent a lot of their time and calories making them hum rather than doing Intel.
Yeah.
So we said, okay. How did the IC standardize this? And what the what NSA did, and what CIA did, was they just said, hey, we're going to expose a lot of our data via APIs. Go consume those. We'll give you the instructions. So we did that. There was a lot of trauma because what we found out the hard way was even if we put the right platform in place, you still have a whole bunch of things downstream you have to feed. You still have to be able to send a fire mission or a call for fire to a FATIDS. And that's a USMTF message. And then you have to get it to the AFATID data network. So we just continued to build all of those downstream connectors on that platform. Jump over. As you think about what we're going to do with next-gen command and control, and as you think about what we're going to do for all of the robotics and autonomy, we're going to flip the premise that you can just put out a set of standards and it will just work, because it doesn't, because there's no implementation guidelines. So you use the cell phone analogy. USB is a standard, but all of the providers implemented it differently. When the iPod came out, Apple implemented it with FireWire until they realized, hey man, this USB thing's probably easier. And then they implemented with Thunderbolt. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until the European government basically told them, hey, you will do USB-C, that they standardized on USB-C. What we can do is something very similar. And actually, I want to give a shout out to the C5ISR Center. So Beth Ferry up at Aberdeen, she held an industry day on batteries on the 13th. So by the time you're listening, it will be earlier in the month. And the question that I asked them was, how do we tell industry, we know that batteries are unique to the platform, right? You're not gonna get a quadcopter to lift a car battery, and you're not gonna run a car off a quadcopter battery. What are the areas of commonality in terms of things like cell management, like battery cell management and charging, that we can go out and tell industry right now, you do what's great for your platform. It's okay that you have a vertically integrated thing. The lowest common denominator is it must be able to charge with this common adapter, and everything else you can tailor to however you need to do business. What that does for us, for our soldiers, is, and I saw this in Hohenfels in January with 3rd Brigade, 10th Mountain, rather than them having to figure out four or five different plugs to charge all their different drones of various flavors, they'll be able to use a common one and actually charge all those batteries and then put them back in the drones. As you think about data interchanges between all of our robots, we, the Army, had this robotic toolkit, RTK, and then we had another follow-on called ARCS. And good idea, you know, good effort by our labs, but it ended up competing with industry because industry had already sort of reverted to a mean of how robots will talk to each other. And a lot of that is, again, through APIs rather than bespoke message formats that make sense to us because that's what we all grew up with. But industry said, we'll find a better way and go faster. So what we're going to do for air autonomy and ground autonomy is just say, hey, what is the right way to implement these APIs for all of our robots? And then we are going to figure out what the right intermediary layer is without vendor locking ourselves to anyone and without pretending like we know what the right answer is, because we don't. We're going to see that evolve over time. So what the Aviation Center is doing with PMUAS is they're working through the Universal Vehicle Controller software layer, and what the RICTO, our Rapid Critical Capabilities Office, and our Director of Integration at AFC, Tony Gibbs, General Gibbs, is working on what are those abstraction layers for all of those robotic platforms, so that any vendor, could be Miller Corp, could be Amble Corp, you can come in and go, oh, I know how to interact with the Army from an autonomy perspective. I'm super excited about it. It's going to be cool. We're going to do a lot of testing in October, doing robotics rodeo.
The battery challenge generally, you know, the fact that they're heavy and we're reliant on them, anything that can be done to simplify that process, and instead of having to carry six batteries for six systems, just because they all need separate batteries, is, I don't want to overstate it, but it would be revolutionary, particularly for infantry soldiers, for example.
Yeah, everyone fell in love with the 5490. So anything that we can do to make that one less cumbersome and have a little bit of commonality, we're going to try. Sort of on that, the challenge with batteries, and commercial industry doesn't generally have to think about this, the most efficient way to move energy around the world is still in liquid form. You still get the most bang for the buck out of liquid energy as opposed to solid energy in the form of batteries. So something that we're experimenting with is what is the right way to move things around? Because what we don't want to create is this weird situation where you are moving batteries back and forth across the battlefield from the FLOT to the BSA or some intermediary, just because you're trying to recharge them. So what it will probably look like is as we think through what standardization of batteries looks like, we also have to think through how do you move energy forward in a way that's useful to recharge them without creating a massive signature or a massive target, because, you know, fuel trucks are moving, they will be targets.
So let's talk about CUAS, the counter-drone challenge. We published an article by a couple of the battalion commanders from 2nd Brigade, 10th Mountain Division, who had, after they had cycled out of Iraq and Syria, who were responsible for base defense, they had faced 100 and some one-way attack UAS, Iranian attack drones primarily, during their time deployed forward. The leader of the Base Defense Operations Center at one of those airfields that faced most of them is now your executive officer. And I understand that's probably indicative of the fact that this is a central problem that, you know, from a technology standpoint, the Army seeks to solve. They were able to defeat and defend against many of those one-way attack drones with a variety of kinetic and non-kinetic measures. But the upshot, based on my conversations with those two battalion commanders and with Anthony, now your XO, and the brigade commander at the time, Colonel Scott Wendt, is we still have a lot of work to do. We were successful, but in the future, because it's not going to be just point defense, it's not going to be just base defense, we're going to have mobile defense mechanisms. And when you look at the scale of the threat, you know, 100 and some one-way attack drones over a 9-month deployment is a lot. It's more than any unit in the Army has faced, but it's nothing compared to the scale that we're seeing, say, play out on the battlefield in Ukraine, for instance. So I guess, how do you, from a starting point, how do you conceptualize that problem and how we can sort of leverage technology to solve it?
Yeah, the thanks for giving Anthony a shout out. He is a national treasure. He's just a great officer, very smart, dedicated to his craft. And then Scott Wins is the same thing. So he's currently, Colonel Scott Wins is currently General Rainey's XO over at the Army Futures Command. What's awesome is giving those two leaders the platform to actually explain what's happening and what's wrong and what needs to happen in the future. So this is an aside and I'll answer your question. This is something the chief is very big on is the Harding Project and being able to write about what you're seeing so that you can actually explain to the rest of the force lessons observed, how you implemented changes, and then ultimately what the lessons learned were. So the way that Anthony saw it and Scott saw as the 2nd Brigade Combat Team 10th Mountain was all of the counter UAS capabilities that we had been developing, particularly for Group 3, so think about your Shaheds, your one-way attack, were really developed under the auspices of point defense. They were running on the same software that had been developed, 2 years after I was born, for Patriot, for CRAM, which saved my life in Afghanistan a couple times. Like, I'm happy CRAM worked, and things like SHORAD. What it didn't do was it didn't give you the collaborative control of sensors and effectors across all of the sensors and effectors that were available. So there was the way that it was architected is one big radar had to go to one FAD C2 box, could go to one Coyote pallet. And they fought that and they hacked their way through the network and they connected things up that I'm sure that all of the RMF gurus would cringe at, but they did it because it was the right thing to do. They came back, and what I had Anthony start working on with the Air Missile Defense Team out at Fort Sill was what do we need to do for command and control? Because that is the most important part of this. We can have all the best sensors, we can have all the best effectors across your kinetic and non-kinetic range, but if they can't talk and you can't task, it doesn't matter. So over the last 6 months, with the help of DIU, with the help of the PEO missiles in space, we've actually been going through a down select for what the next generation of that software is, period. In February, the chief of the UK Army, General Rolly Walker, and the chief of our Army, General George, sat down and said, hey, we probably need to do a maneuver counter UAS exercise to think through how do you protect that squad, that platoon, that company, that battalion on the move in a battle space when they won't have coverage from these big high-end radars. They probably won't be attacked by, you know, the group threes. They're not a rich enough target, but they will be attacked by group one and two drones. So quadcopters and multi-rotors and maybe some fixed wing assets. So we stood up a project, an operation called Flytrap with 2nd Cavalry Regiment and 5th Corps. So Colonel Matt Davis at 5th Corps has been absolutely awesome, worked for General Donahue. And then Colonel Don Neal, the 2CR commander, they put together this exercise. I actually went over to Hohenfels to sit and see what was going on. And what they found was, hey, we have some pretty good sensors across the RF acoustic and optical space. Our big challenge is taking all of that raw telemetry data coming off of them, fusing it together on a striker or on a vehicle, and then minimizing what goes out. Because, and this is a good lesson to learn on the training range, not in combat, just moving all that raw sensor data was chewing up 70-80% of the bandwidth of all the tactical radios.
Wow.
So I went, hey, that's, you know, everybody was sort of like, ah, that's a lot. It is, but I'm happy that we learned it there, because what we are turning on now for Flytrap 5.0, so we did, we took a page out of CENTCOM's book and did 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0 was a live fire in Poland. What we're going to do for 5.0 in November through the end of the year is think through, okay, how do we apply technology to do data minimization, so things like AI at the sensors, track fusion, so that an infantryman who has a TAC device doesn't have to manage his or her own airspace. They can actually have that automatically generated. And then how do you do asset management to set up rules of engagement that says, hey, if it's coming at you and it hits this threshold, you can kill it. And if your non-kinetic effects don't work, go kinetic with things like the blade that the Crows, they're older systems, but we'll work on the replacements that can sling, you know, 5.56, 7.62, 50 cal rather than wasting $100,000 missiles. So I'm super excited. I got the right team working on this, and the Army has the right team working on it, and that's what we've been doing for the last couple of months.
How difficult is the element of scale in this? Because, you know, CRAM is a wonder. It puts up a wall of lead, and that's great if you're facing 1, 2, 10, even a couple dozen incoming unmanned systems. But if we're talking 100, 1,000 swarms, that's not practical, obviously. And so I guess, how do you think about the question of scale, how you lay the foundation now for a system that works for the scale that we're likely to face tomorrow, but will also continue to work, you know, as that challenge grows, you know, in the years to come?
Yep. So good question. So there's two ways that I think about it. The first one is making sure that all of the assets that we have for whatever echelon actually work together. So you're right. If you're a platoon and you've got two strikers and you've only got, you know, a 30 mic and a 50 cal, you're going to have a hard time fighting 1,000 drones. However, as long as all of your weapon systems, kinetic and non-kinetic, are working together, your chance of survival goes up. The other way to think about it is this is an area where we actually are making investments and want more investment in things like directed energy. Because this is where we need the wall of energy, whether it's from something like a high power microwave, which just puts a wall of energy out and interacts, you know, negatively for the drone with the microelectronics, or things like lasers, where instead of having a 10-second burn time, you can have a 2-second burn time and, you know, jump from target to target. But 100% of that is dependent on making sure that all of your sensors, all of your effectors all work together in a meaningful way, not just onesies and twosies. So the foundation that we're going after really is that C2, because then we can work on scaling by adding more sensors and effectors in.
I kind of want to zoom out then, and maybe we'll end with this. You know, you and I met last year at AUSA and talked a bit on the exhibition floor. And for anybody who has not been to AUSA, it's something. The exhibition floor has all sorts of things, because there are just, you know, there's no end to the number of companies that have widgets and what have you that they want to sell to the Army. A lot of that stuff is never going to be bought and is never going to be fielded. And so the challenge, particularly as the pace of change, you know, on the technological landscape increases, accelerates, the challenge is sort of, I guess, discerning between solutions and snake oil. How much of your kind of bandwidth is devoted toward that. And just because, you know, you could spend all of your waking hours on so many projects that just maybe aren't high enough priority or aren't going to pan out in the end. Is that a major concern?
It is. This is going to sound a little flippant, because it is. Most of the stuff that people are trying to sell us just doesn't do what it says it's going to do. And it's not malice. It's not malfeasance. It's just they haven't had access to the real environment to prove that the technology can work. This was sort of the mindset for transforming in contact, where we said, okay, we're going to call bluffs on a lot of things. We're going to take it to the field and we're going to try it. If technology is even directionally aligned with where we're trying to go, it's got a fighting opportunity for the Army to look at it. Now, that being said, you're right. There's lots of widgets. A lot of them try to do the exact same thing. They try to fill a known gap in a market. So what we are trying to figure out now is, and this is us learning from industry learning for us, is we know that the total addressable market for the Army is sort of fixed. We know that we have formations. We know how we're going to fight at echelon for the most part. So what we're trying to figure out now is what's addressable within that, and then what needs to change from a process perspective. Most of the counter UAS things that we're going after now, the protection warfighting function, which owned all of that for the longest time, that was just relegated to air defense. So yeah. Now as we think through, you know, what's the total addressable market for protection? Well, now it's every infantryman, it's every driver, it's everyone, because everyone will have to be thinking about counter UAS. Same thing with fires. Like, the total addressable market for fires is changing, because everything should be a spotter. You should be able to call for fire from every drone. And in fact, one of the medic teams for 3rd Brigade 10th Mountain, when they were at Hohenfels at GMRC in January, February, they were able to use one of their drones looking for casualties to spot Warrior, which is the Op-4 out there, and do a call for fire. So all of the capabilities, all of the things that vendors want to sell, they won't have a home. But that's where rigorous competition comes in. That's where partnerships come in. What we want less of is winner take all. What we want more of is, hey, like, work together and figure out what the best capabilities and solutions are. Don't bring me your vertical black box, which 10% of it's really just the best thing ever, and 90% of it's crap that you think you have to give us because, you know, it addresses a requirement. Bring the team together that says, hey, this whole thing works really, really well because we've got, you know, Alex doing part of it, we've got Matt doing part of it, we've got John doing part of it, and they're doing the best thing that they can as part of this team, which is actually the approach that we took to Next Generation Command and Control, rather than saying, hey, we're going to do a large defense prime and a lead systems integrator. We said, bring a team, bring the right people to the team that do their thing really well, and we're going to do there. So that's a long way, and I don't think I actually answered your question, but the majority of my job is sorting through what's working and what's not working. And the way that we exercise that is with TIC right now.
Yeah. Well, Alex, thank you again for joining me today. I think we'll leave it there. We could probably have you back on in a few months, just because the pace of change is so dramatic. But also because, you know, we touched on CUAS, but there are a number of other practical applications that we didn't. So if we can have you back on at some point in the future, that would be fantastic. But I appreciate your time today, sharing some of your insights. It's been a really fascinating conversation for me. So I trust it will be for listeners as well.
Yeah, John, I appreciate you giving me a voice and an opportunity, and let me talk about what the chief and the secretary are trying to do. So as always, if your audience has questions, I'm always open to reengaging.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing before you go. If you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.